Before we dive in, I want to let you know that this entire episode, including the voices you're hearing, is AI generated. Today's show is brought to you by MindBridge Pro, a fictional conversation analysis app that helps you track dialogue patterns in real time. And as always, some details in our discussion might be inaccurate, so please fact-check anything important to you. I'm Sarah, and today we're exploring a book that tackles one of the most pressing challenges of our time. How do you have productive conversations about topics that seem to shut down dialogue entirely? My guest is Peter Boghossian, philosopher and author of How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. Peter, let's start with why this book exists at all.
We're living in an era where people seem unable to talk to each other about anything meaningful. Climate change, politics, religion, social issues. These conversations either don't happen or they explode into conflict.
You call these impossible conversations. What makes them impossible, exactly?
They're the conversations that people avoid because they expect them to go badly. The ones where people have deeply held beliefs and strong emotional investments in being right. What I found is that most people think these conversations fail because of the topics themselves. But that's not true. They fail because of how we approach them.
So you're saying the problem isn't what we're talking about, but how we're talking about it.
Exactly. And that's something we can actually fix. We can learn specific techniques and approaches that make these conversations not just possible, but productive.
Your background is in philosophy, specifically moral reasoning and critical thinking. How did that lead you to focus on conversation techniques?
Spent years teaching people how to think more clearly about complex issues. But I realized that thinking clearly doesn't matter much if you can't communicate those ideas to others. I was also doing street epistemology, actually going out and having these difficult conversations with strangers. That gave me real-world data about what works and what doesn't.
Street epistemology is essentially testing philosophical ideas in everyday conversations with regular people, right?
Right. Instead of just theorizing about how people form beliefs and change their minds, I was actually engaging with people who held very different views from mine.
What did you discover that surprised you most?
That people are much more willing to engage with challenging ideas than we assume, but only if you approach them in the right way.
Let's dig into the central thesis of your book. What's the core argument you're making?
The main claim is that impossible conversations become possible when you focus on the process of conversation rather than trying to win or convince people of specific content. Most people enter difficult conversations with the goal of changing someone's mind about a particular issue. That almost never works, and it usually makes things worse.
So what should the goal be instead?
Goal should be to understand how the other person thinks and to model better ways of reasoning together. If you do that well, belief change often happens naturally.
You're drawing on the Socratic method here, aren't you? This isn't entirely new territory.
Absolutely. Socrates figured out thousands of years ago that asking good questions is more powerful than making statements. But most people today don't know how to ask good questions. They ask questions that are really just disguised arguments or attacks. Don't you think it's obvious that that's not a genuine question?
What makes this approach different from traditional debate or persuasion techniques?
Traditional debate assumes that one person is right and the other is wrong, and the goal is to prove who's who. This approach assumes that both people have something to learn. It's also different from most persuasion techniques because it's not manipulative. You're not trying to trick someone into changing their mind. You're genuinely exploring ideas together.
Surely you must have some beliefs you want to promote. You're not completely neutral, are you?
Of course I have beliefs. But I've learned that the best way to promote good reasoning and evidence-based thinking is to model it, not to preach it. When someone sees you genuinely trying to understand their perspective and asking thoughtful questions, they often start doing the same thing back.
who argue that this matters because we're facing what you call an epistemic crisis. Can you explain that, Jane?
An epistemic crisis is a situation where people can't agree on how to determine what's true. It's not just that we disagree about facts. We disagree about how to figure out what the facts are. Some people trust scientific institutions, others don't. Some people trust traditional media, others don't. Some people trust their personal experience, others rely more on data.
And you think better conversations can help solve this?
I think they're essential. If we can't have productive conversations about how we know things, we can't make progress on any of the big challenges we're facing.
All right, let's get into the practical tools. What's the first technique you teach people?
The first and most important technique is what I call building rapport. Before you can have any difficult conversation, the other person has to trust that you're not trying to attack them.
How do you build that trust concretely?
Start by finding something you genuinely respect about their position. Not fake flattery, but something real. Maybe they care deeply about an important issue, even if you disagree with their conclusions. Talked with someone who believed vaccines cause autism. I started by acknowledging how much they cared about children's health and how hard it must be to navigate conflicting information as a parent.
What happened in that conversation?
Once they felt heard and respected, they were willing to explore questions about how they had formed their beliefs about vaccines. We didn't resolve everything in one conversation, but they started asking better questions.
Second major technique you teach is something called clarifying terms. Why is this so important?
Most impossible conversations involve terms that people use differently without realizing it. Words like freedom, justice, natural, or healthy mean very different things to different people.
Can you give me a concrete example of how this plays out?
I was in a conversation about whether certain foods are natural. One person meant not processed in a factory. Another meant found in nature without human intervention. Those are completely different standards. Once we clarified what each person meant by natural, we could actually have a productive conversation about food processing and health.
How do you get people to define their terms without making it feel like a vocabulary lesson?
You ask genuine questions about what they mean. When you say that policy is unfair, what does fairness look like to you? Or, help me understand what you mean by natural in this context.
Third technique is what you call listening for values. What does that mean exactly?
Behind every strong opinion is usually a deeply held value. Someone who opposes a particular policy might value individual freedom, community safety, economic prosperity, or environmental protection. If you can identify and acknowledge those underlying values, you can have a much more productive conversation about how to achieve them.
Let's say I'm talking to someone who opposes renewable energy policies. How would I listen for their values?
You might ask, what concerns you most about these policies? They might say they worry about job losses in traditional energy sectors. That tells you they value economic security for working people. Now, you can have a conversation about the best ways to protect workers during an energy transition, rather than arguing about whether climate change is real.
That seems like it would completely change the dynamic of the conversation.
It does. Instead of being adversaries arguing about positions, you become collaborators trying to solve a problem that you both care about.
Now let's talk about what you call the question menu. This seems to be the heart of your method.
The question menu is a set of question types that help people examine their own beliefs. The key is that these aren't gotcha questions designed to trap people. They're genuine inquiries.
What's the first type of question on this menu?
Questions about belief formation. How did you come to believe that? Or, what first convinced you of this idea? These help people reflect on the sources of their beliefs. Most people have never really thought about where their beliefs came from. They just have them. These questions create space for that reflection.
Can you walk me through how this might work with a specific example?
Sure. Let's say someone believes that immigrants are taking jobs from American workers. Instead of arguing with statistics, you might ask, what experiences or information led you to that conclusion? They might tell you about a factory that closed in their town around the same time immigration increased. Now you can explore that connection thoughtfully, rather than just dismissing their concerns.
What's the next type of question?
Questions about evidence and confidence. On a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you in this belief? And what kind of evidence might change your mind?
Why the confidence scale? That seems almost mathematical for a conversation about beliefs.
It helps people recognize that beliefs aren't just true or false. They exist on a spectrum of confidence. Someone might be 60% confident rather than 100% confident. And that opens up space for dialogue. It also helps you understand how to approach the conversation. If someone is 95% confident, you need a different strategy than if they're 60% confident.
What about the evidence question? Don't people often say nothing could change their mind?
Sometimes they do, but often that's just their initial defensive response. If you stay curious and non-threatening, many people will start to think about it more seriously. And if they truly say nothing could change their mind, that's valuable information too. It tells you this might not be a productive conversation to have right now.
The third type of question involves exploring consequences. How does this work?
You ask people to think through the implications of their beliefs. If this is true, what else would we expect to see? Or what would the world look like if everyone believed this?
Give me a concrete scenario where this might be useful.
Someone believes that all government regulation is bad for the economy. You might ask, if that's true, would we expect to see countries with less regulation always having stronger economies? This invites them to think about the evidence they would expect to see if their belief were correct, which often leads to more nuanced thinking.
You also talk about questions that explore alternative explanations. How do these fit in?
These help people consider whether there might be other ways to explain the same observations. What are some other possible reasons this might be happening? This is especially useful when people have jumped to conclusions based on limited information or have focused on one possible explanation while ignoring others.
Let's talk about implementation. When someone first tries these techniques, what typically goes wrong?
The biggest mistake is asking questions that aren't really questions. People think they're using the Socratic method, but they're actually just making arguments in the form of questions.
What does that sound like?
Don't you think it's obvious that climate change is caused by human activity? That's not a question. That's an argument with a question mark at the end. A real question would be something like, what evidence do you find most compelling when you think about climate change? That's genuinely seeking to understand their perspective.
What's the second most common mistake?
Moving too fast. People want to get to the big questions immediately, but you have to build up to them. Start with easier, less threatening questions and work your way up.
How do you know if you're moving too fast?
The other person will start getting defensive. They might change the subject, get emotional, or start attacking your views instead of exploring their own. When that happens, you need to slow down and rebuild rapport. Maybe acknowledge that you're asking challenging questions and appreciate their willingness to engage.
Let's say I'm having a conversation and it starts going well, but then it derails. What do I do?
First, don't panic. It's normal for these conversations to have ups and downs. You can often get back on track by returning to something you both agreed on earlier. You might say something like, I think we both care about finding solutions that actually work. Can we go back to exploring what that might look like?
How long does it typically take to see results with these methods?
Depends what you mean by results. You might see the quality of the conversation improve within minutes if you're genuinely curious and respectful. But actual belief change? That usually takes multiple conversations over weeks or months. People need time to process new ideas and integrate them with their existing worldview.
That's quite different from our culture's expectation of instant persuasion, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're used to thinking that if we just present the right argument or the right facts, people should change their minds immediately. But that's not how human psychology works.
What about situations where there really are urgent decisions to be made? Can you afford to take months to change someone's mind?
That's a fair challenge. In urgent situations, you might not be able to change deeply held beliefs, but you can still use these techniques to find common ground for immediate action. Focus on shared values and practical next steps, rather than trying to resolve fundamental worldview differences.
Let's talk about adaptation. How do these methods work in different contexts? What about professional settings versus family dinner tables?
The core principles are the same, but you need to adjust your approach. In professional settings, you might focus more on practical outcomes and less on personal beliefs. With family members, you have the advantage of existing relationships, but also the disadvantage that people might have years of baggage around certain topics.
What's your advice for someone who wants to try this with a family member they've been arguing with for years?
Start by taking a break from the topic that's been causing problems. Focus on rebuilding your relationship first. Show them that you can listen and be curious about other aspects of their life. Then, when you do return to the difficult topic, acknowledge that you've both gotten stuck in unproductive patterns in the past and you'd like to try a different approach.
What if someone only does one thing from your book? What should that one thing be?
Ask more genuine questions and make fewer statements. Most people talk too much and listen too little in difficult conversations.
Can you give me the most specific version of that advice possible?
For every statement you make about what you believe, ask at least 3 questions about what the other person believes and why they believe it.
Now let's do some critical evaluation. What does your book do really well?
I think it provides concrete, practical tools that people can actually use. A lot of books about communication are full of abstract principles, but this one gives you specific questions to ask and techniques to practice.
Where do you think the book might overpromise or fall short?
I think some readers might expect these techniques to work in situations where dialogue just isn't possible. If someone is not engaging in good faith or if they're dealing with serious mental health issues, these methods have limitations. The book also focuses primarily on individual conversations. But many of our biggest challenges require systemic changes, not just better one-on-one communication.
How does your approach compare to other work in this space? There are lots of books about difficult conversations.
Most books in this area focus on managing emotions or finding compromise. This book is more focused on helping people examine the reasoning behind their beliefs. It's also more philosophically grounded. It's not just about getting along with people. It's about improving the quality of human reasoning and decision-making.
What does the book leave out that readers should look for elsewhere?
It doesn't spend much time on the psychological and emotional aspects of belief change. For that, you might want to read work by social psychologists or therapists who specialize in cognitive change. It also doesn't address power dynamics very thoroughly. Sometimes conversations fail not because of poor technique, but because of inequality in the relationship.
Are there situations where you'd actually recommend against using these techniques?
If someone is being abusive or manipulative, don't try to have philosophical conversations with them. Set boundaries and protect yourself first. Also, if you're not genuinely curious about the other person's perspective, don't fake it. People can tell when you're being manipulative, and it will backfire.
Let's talk about the book's impact. How has it been received since it was published?
It's been used by educators, activists, and just regular people who want to have better conversations with friends and family. I've heard from people who say it's helped them reconnect with relatives they'd been estranged from over political differences.
Has it faced any significant criticism?
Some critics argue that it places too much emphasis on individual conversations and not enough on addressing structural problems. Others worry that it can be used to legitimize harmful beliefs by treating them as worthy of serious discussion.
How do you respond to that second criticism?
I think there's a difference between taking someone's reasoning process seriously and legitimizing harmful conclusions. You can help someone improve their thinking without accepting everything they currently believe.
What's changed in the conversation landscape since you wrote the book?
Social media has continued to make things more challenging. People are even more polarized and even more used to quick, shallow exchanges rather than deep, thoughtful dialogue. But I've also seen more interest in these kinds of skills. People are hungry for better ways to communicate across differences.
If you were writing the book today, what would you do differently?
I'd probably spend more time addressing online communication and the challenges of having these conversations through social media and text rather than face-to-face.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important thing you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
That impossible conversations become possible when you approach them with genuine curiosity rather than a desire to win. Most of the conversations we avoid don't have to be impossible.
And the one thing they should do differently starting tomorrow.
The next time someone says something you disagree with, instead of explaining why they're wrong, ask them a genuine question about how they came to that conclusion.
Peter Boghossian, author of How to Have Impossible Conversations. Thanks for helping us think more clearly about how we talk to each other.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. And thanks for modeling the kind of curious questioning that makes good conversations possible.